broadcasting from Melbourne, Victoria. You're listening to the Investor Exchange. Tune in each week and listen to the guys from United Global Capital discuss the topics that matter the most to your finances. Each episode will help you separate the noise from what really matters, giving you timely and actionable information you can use. We'll cover areas related to financial markets, property, politics, personal finance, and the economy. Now, here's your host.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of The Wide World of Investor Exchange.
Nice touch.
Joining me this morning, as usual, is Joel Hewish.
Good morning, everybody.
Brett Dickinson.
I'm here.
My name's Louis Van Copenhagen, and we're going to take you through the next 40 minutes, 50 minutes of investment glory.
Yeah. And a quick shout out to our usual host, Steph, who's out working hard.
Yes, she is.
Thanks, Steph.
Having a lot of fun on a corporate junket.
Yeah. Nice for her.
Not quite.
But anyway. And it's probably just as well because we don't have a seat for her today.
Yeah,
the walls are closing in on us.
Office is overflowing.
Yeah.
Right. Well, gents, it's been another amazing week.
Mm.
The market turmoil continues, that's for sure.
Well, certainly the volatility does.
Yeah. Well, Joel, what's going on?
Well, actually, before that, the one thing that we spoke in depth about last week turned into quite a fizzer, didn't it, with the election?
Yeah.
Well, it was just a landslide.
That's wow, true.
What a whitewash.
Absolutely. State Labor government being voted in hands down. Fair to say the Liberal Party got pantsed in Victoria.
Did they ever? Matthew Guy has now resigned.
He did.
Yeah, I believe he.
It's hard to be a leader in the wake of that, isn't it?
It is disastrous.
To retain your position.
Yep,
wow.
That's right.
Anyway.
And the Liberals, you know, Victoria used to be, one of the Liberals, jewels in the crown, they used to say. And, geez, wow.
How the mighty have fallen.
Yep.
There you go.
Most definitely.
Mm. Right. Well, getting into it, Joel, I'm very curious to hear your opinion on the markets because people keep coming up to tell me that the markets are still tanking, and I'll try and tell them, no, they're not tanking, it's just volatile. Yeah. Joel, what's the difference?
Well, this is certainly not a bear market. This doesn't have any of the hallmarks of a bear market. You know, usually what you would see at a bear market is inverted yield curves, particularly in the US Treasury bond market. We're not seeing that. We would usually see financial stress and corporate bond spreads between high-grade and low-grade corporate debt widen leading into the correction. We didn't see that. We would usually see already negative earnings growth in corporate profits. Well, we're certainly not seeing that. In fact, we've seen one of the most stunning quarters of corporate profit growth in the US in the last decade. So we're not seeing any of the hallmarks that you would see for a big bear market to start. In actual fact, much of the market action that we're looking at, yes, 2018's been extraordinarily volatile. We had a big rally in January and then we had a big sell-off in February. And that volatility continued all the way through until March, and then we started to find some stronger footing in the middle of the year, and then we've had another big sell-off through September and October. And look, a lot of this sell-off was really around the market trying to get its head around. We've come through this real purple patch. We've had this corporate profit growth in the US that has been at a level that's been really, some of the most impressive levels that we've seen in the last decade. Largely on the back of corporate tax cuts that were pushed through by the Trump administration. And we're seeing the effects of that on corporate profits in the United States at the moment. But the market's now saying, okay, well, what's next? We've seen this great juice to earnings. Where is the market going to go? We've seen the Fed is tightening interest rates. There's this uncertainty around how quickly the US Federal Reserve, the central bank of basically the world, how quickly they're going to tighten interest rates to try and cool the US economy, because the US economy is very strong. And I think it wasn't really helped with Jerome Powell, who came out and probably made a bit of a rookie mistake in early October, where he said that the US Federal Reserve cash rate is, some way off neutral. Well, you know, given the last 8 weeks and what's come off the back of that, he's had to take a bit of a step back this week, and he's been a little bit more dovish, a little bit less hawkish in his comments, and he's now said that they're not too far away from neutral. So the market is still expecting a quarter of a point rise in the US Fed funds rate in December, but where there was concern that the Fed may have risen rates far too aggressively in 2019. And it now appears that the Fed is now looking at some of the data. It's seeing some of the evidence of slowing around the world. And it's also seeing some of those trade tensions between the US and China. And it's starting to take a little bit more of a sensible approach. And really what Jerome Powell should have said back in October was the economy is strong, but we're going to be data dependent. And instead, he said that, you know, we're, you know, quite some way away from neutral, which, you know, scared the pants off a lot of people and thought that there could have been a policy mistake by the Fed and, you know, accidentally tipped the US into a recession that it didn't need to go into. Now, if you know anything about the Fed and you've watched the way that they operate over the last, you know, 100 years or so since their existence, they're almost perfect in their ability to send the US economy into recession at the wrong time.
impeccable record
of failure. So, you know, the market, you know, understands that there is probably no greater influence on asset prices around the world than what the Fed does. Mm. I mean, it's extraordinary the power that that institution has to influence asset prices and the global economy. And so it is really important to understand what the Fed is doing. And when the comments are a little bit, you know, aggressive, and we've already got a little bit of froth in valuations in some parts of the market, like technology and healthcare and a few of these other higher growth areas, you know, that's going to cause some sort of, you know, risk off and risk reduction, which is what we've seen.
Well, it's a bit of an art form, really. The central banks, the Reserve Bank in Australia, the Fed in the USA, there's two things they can do to affect the economy. Mm. They can alter interest rates, or they can talk about altering interest rates.
Yep, definitely.
That's really the two big tools that they've got.
Yep.
And doing each of those things has a different effect. So, yeah, he might have made a mistake in what he said, or did he? Because if he talks about a raise in rates, that affects financial markets and business lending, but it tends not to hurt residential lending so much. So it's possibly that he's trying to push one thing while pulling back on another.
Yeah.
But then he did change his words later, so maybe the message was too strong. It's just interesting to see what has happened, and was there a mistake or was there not a mistake? Did he do what was intended?
Look, he's only new in the job. I think he's only been in the job for a number of months, really. And we saw a similar sort of sell-off when
Bernanke,
Janet Yellen first entered into the position as well, where she made some comments that perhaps, you know, around interest rates and the rate of change in interest rates that may have you know, sent the market into a, you know, bit of a, that did send the market into a bit of a tailspin when she first got in. And I think it's just sometimes, you know, the people don't actually realize, these people don't actually realize the power that they possess with the word of, you know, with the speech that comes out of their
purely
mouth.
Purely because of their position.
Absolutely. Mm. So, you know, look, he'll learn from it.
Yeah.
He'll be a better guider to the market. And if there's any one good thing to come out of it, it's certainly taken some froth out of the market, which from my perspective is a really attractive thing, because now we have a much more solid base to be able to see high prices over the next 12 and 18 months.
Great.
Yeah,
great.
We're starting from a position where valuations are now no longer as frothy as what they were, but yet the underlying fundamentals are still very, very strong.
Mm, very good. Interesting. All right, well, it's nice to get that insight, Joel. Tell me a bit more about what price action is actually happening.
So, very encouragingly, we have seen a bottom in the Australian stock market. Now, what we tend to see at the lows of a stock market that's in a deep correction is it's not usually the first push lower that puts in the bottom. You usually need a second test of that low. Now, a lot of the time, that second test needs to create panic and fear in investors. It needs to create some capitulation. And how they do that, how the market makers do that, and how the funds and the algorithms do that is by pushing the second test of that low just slightly below the previous low. So you usually get this undercutting that happens. And we've seen this time and time again over the past 10 years where we've had corrections in 2010, 2011, 2015 and 16, and again, you know, in 2018, where we've had these 10% or greater corrections, and those corrections don't actually start to resolve themselves until we see the second push lower that slightly undercuts for a day or two, and then it rallies strongly off that base. Now,
and you see that kind of price action in the big market indices,
yep,
but you also see it in individual share prices as well.
Absolutely.
And you see those all the time.
Correct. And that gives us clues, actually, as to where the leadership might present when the market starts to recover. What we are looking for is when that market, when the market more broadly undercuts the previous low that happens 5 or 6 weeks earlier, the stocks that don't undercut that low and make a higher low are often the ones that rally the strongest out of the recovery.
Mm.
So what we've been doing a ton of over the past couple of weeks is just screening the market like mad, trying to come up with a list of stocks that are showing that relative strength. And we can use some technical indicators that'll show how strong that price performance is of that stock relative to the S&P 500 or the ASX 200. And, you know, for using that software that we've got, which is very powerful, we're able to come up with a list of stocks that we can hone in on that are showing that relative strength that is almost like, you know, that springboard that comes out that, you know, if you get the S&P 500 rallying by 10%, you'll get these stocks rallying 15, 20, 25% coming out of that low. But that doesn't mean that those stocks don't still have a fairly painful pullback during the correction as well.
Mm.
You know, they can pull back 10, 15, 20%. But what we are looking for is which are the ones that are attracting that support and that leadership and that buying strength while everything else is selling and,
okay,
and showing that weakness.
So price action of the specific companies, but what about the underlying earnings?
Well, this is the time where you have to focus very much on the quality of the business, strong balance sheets, and the growth that the underlying business is generating. So it's no good, you know, just looking at price action and not considering the underlying performance of the company as well, okay? And usually what you'll find is that the stocks that are seeing the highest revenue growth and the highest profit growth and the least amount of volatility in their earnings and in their financial performance are also the ones that tend to be the ones that rally out of the show the strongest relative strength through these corrections. So we're seeing a number of opportunities, and I think now, given that we've had this what we call an upward thrust or a follow through day coming out of the low on Wednesday, and I'll explain what that is just very briefly. So what a follow through day is that it's the largest upward move that you see that usually takes place around about 4 to 10 days after the low and after the undercut happens. Now, that's confirmation that institutional buying power is now buying into this depressed market, and they're buying with aggression and they're buying with big volume and big money. That's what we would like to see coming out of this correction. We actually got that on Wednesday night. So we had the NASDAQ up almost 3%. We had pretty much every sector up on that day this week. And that was the sort of price action that gives me a hell of a lot of confidence that we're probably going to be seeing higher prices, not just over the medium term, but probably in the short term as well, and probably significantly higher prices. I mean, at the moment, you know, most the S&P 500 is probably flat for the year, year to date. I would not be surprised if you see the S&P 500 up 5% before we get to the end of December. You know, it's very possible. And in that environment, we'd expect many of our stocks to be up 10% and 15%.
Wow, that's quite a rise in a short time.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah. So it's very, very encouraging price action. With the sentiment concerns around the Fed being removed, yet we're seeing, you know, the strongest corporate profit growth since 2010. The underlying fundamentals are much better than what the news lines would lead you to believe.
Is it fair to say the news headlines are reporting the downs but not the ups?
Oh, no doubt about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we have an up week and the news doesn't say anything, and then we have a down week and the news says,
yeah,
it's down.
The sky's falling.
Yeah. No, they never ever say 50 billion added to stocks. Yeah. It's always 50 billion wiped off stocks, you know?
Yeah. That's right.
That's, you know, always a big headline, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Crazy. Well, thanks for that, Joel. Really good insights. So listeners, we're going to take a short break. We'll be with you shortly.
Want to learn the strategies that have achieved returns more than double the return of the average superannuation fund? Each day, clients of United Global Capital are using strategies and tactics that were once thought the domain of the professional investor or the super rich. Book your seat at UGC's Financial Fast Track Seminars, where you'll learn the science behind selecting high-performance stocks and real estate, how you can participate in advanced strategies like property development, short selling, and international investments, as well as how to protect your wealth against major adverse market events. To secure your seat, simply go to ugc.net.au/events and select the seminar that suits your needs. Seats are limited, so book your spot now.
Welcome back, listeners. I'm going to kick it over to Brett now. Brett, what's been happening this week in your world?
Well, a lot happening, but the main thing I wanted to discuss was in regard to previous information we'd shared in another episode about how a lot of the major banks had withdrawn from the SMSF lending space. So people that were wanting to buy property in their self-managed super fund and obtain a loan to be able to purchase that are now really struggling, and there's minimal lenders around that are willing to do so now. And what we've found is not only are there less lenders, their LVRs are decreasing, so loan-to-value ratios, so the amount of borrowings you could get within a self-managed super fund, and their rates are being jacked up significantly as well, that I'm going to call that it's virtually not feasible to buy a property within your self-managed super fund if you need to borrow.
Yeah.
It just doesn't make sense anymore.
Wow. That's a big shift.
It is. And it's a shame because it was a healthy strategy if you were able to get the right level of borrowings at the right rate.
Yeah. And if it was done prudently, it was a very attractive strategy for wealth creation.
Right. So, Brett, why do you think this has happened?
Look, a combination of things. If we trace back to when the non-recourse borrowing, so within SMS, within a self-managed super fund environment, because of, you know, the superannuation structure, the asset itself, which is the property, if it's going to be lent against, as in a bank's going to lend, it can't have recourse against any other assets that the super fund owns.
Right.
So it was a different type of security that the banks would be able to take.
And it's different to a personally purchased property when you are personally a guarantor to the loan that you take against your other assets, your home and your car and those sorts of things.
Yeah. So when the law was passed to allow those loans to happen, a lot of property spruikers and you know, people in the property industry saw great a new market that we can start to attract and sell through. And unfortunately, whenever there's a new market, it gets exploited by good people, but also by bad people or people without the right ethics and integrity.
Mm. Yep.
And over time, a lot of people that were, you know, sellers of off the plan stock with high commissions and everything else saw, wow, let's just convert a lot of these people that have got super into a self-managed environment and get them to buy property because now there's a way to do so. And over time, I think a lot of these properties weren't solid investment properties and a lot of people were being sort of sold into them without really having enough of a super balance or enough of an understanding.
Right.
And it was really putting a lot of those people at risk. So
I
think over time, you know, the industry wises up.
Yeah.
And a lot of the banks have sort of seen that it's not a major part of their borrowing business. So they're probably not willing to take on those risks and expose themselves to it as much for what it's worth.
Mm. It's a lot of reputational risk for
Absolutely.
A bank who lends to a super fund for a property that might be a dud.
Yeah.
And then the bank gets involved and the bank is left holding the can with an undervalued property.
Yeah. And if you look at it, it's typical mortgage, if it's not in a super environment, they look at the loan-to-value ratio, of course, and then they look at serviceability. And when they look at serviceability, if it's a single person that's the owner or it's a couple, you know, they look at their wages and they put buffers and everything in there. Now, when it's a super fund, well, the only servicing can either come from the rent, which they discount to some degree, or the contributions being made. And contributions into super are typically a lot lower than what a wage is for repayments. So it is a riskier loan for the banks in that respect.
Yeah.
It's, you know, I think it was a good policy poorly implemented, and there was perhaps some unintended consequences that weren't foreseen when they first implemented this.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and it's always in hindsight, but, you know, had perhaps the superannuation fund lending to real estate had been implemented with mandated caps on LVRs of maybe 70% and, you know, you had to have a superannuation balance greater than $300,000, it could have been something that would have worked very, very nicely.
If they put some parameters like that,
yeah.
it'd work well.
Yeah, but the way that it was implemented allowed for these spruikers to, you know, sell properties with people who only had $30,000 worth of superannuation,
yeah.
And you know, just made it a very risky proposition.
So you're talking about the LVR being lower, and we understand the impact of that means you need a larger amount of your super to be used for the property purchase where you were going to borrow and get additional leverage. But what about the interest rate being higher? How much higher are we talking?
A lot.
Significantly.
Yeah.
Really?
So, yeah. So with the LVRs, we don't necessarily mind that the LVRs are a little bit lower because we think it makes sense not to be too aggressive in a, you know, with any property purchase for investment, and certainly within a super environment. But, you know, if the strategy works on a certain amount of borrowings that you're going to start exploring the market on, you want to know that that's the outcome you can get.
Yeah.
So we're not too concerned that the LVRs have dropped. As long as we know where they're at, we can plan for that. But when the interest rate is sort of 2 to 3% above what you could get if you were buying a residential property outside of super,
oh, wow. Yeah.
That's a real hurting impact in terms of your ability to service that. It becomes virtually untenable.
Yeah.
So, I mean, wait, we're talking about...
We're talking rates close to 7% inside super, whereas if you apply for a home mortgage outside of super, you can get rates still under 4%.
Right. Wow. So instead of 4%, you're paying 7%.
Yeah.
That's what a... three quarters higher, two thirds higher on your interest repayments, which is a massive amount.
Well, and if you think, you know, most investments are sort of in that price bracket of say $400,000 to $700,000 is probably the range that most investment properties are, and especially in super, they're probably in that range.
Yep.
So, assuming you've got borrowings of $400,000 that you're getting. 3% of that is what, $12,000 a year you've got to find.
Yeah.
Yeah.
On top of what it would be if it was outside of super.
Yeah. Well, that's amazing. That's just lost cash flow, dead money.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole point of investing inside super is that you're in a low tax environment, but when it's costing you an extra $12,000 just in lost cash flow each year.
Yeah.
The tax deductions don't really matter, do they?
No. Yeah. No, it becomes
it becomes a very risky strategy because you're relying so much on future growth. And given the growth that we've already gone through over the past, well, you know, at least over the last 6 or 7 years, you know, you would have to say that the larger capital cities like Melbourne and Sydney and, you know, perhaps some of the others as well, they're going to struggle to get, you know, growth rates up around 5 and 6% over the next decade.
Yeah.
I think it's more likely that you're going to be seeing sort of, you know, 3s to 4% growth, if you're lucky, on average. And
which is basically the difference in your interest rate.
Yeah. So, you know, unless that property is outpacing the negative cash flow by a substantial amount, you're now starting to adapt a very risky strategy for real estate investment.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Well, and it's just hurting your super fund balance because you're constantly, whatever you're contributing is going towards holding the property.
Yeah.
If the growth isn't there, well, you've lost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
So not seeing too much action going to be happening in that space.
So
in the near future.
What's the plan then for someone who was thinking about property inside super and now buying an investment property directly is not really an option unless you're an investor who has probably millions in your super fund.
That's a different story.
And you don't need to borrow, and you can have property as a certain allocation of your overall portfolio.
Yeah.
But for the majority of people who don't have millions in their super funds, who are trying to accumulate wealth here, what's their options?
Well, I guess if we simplified a little bit to look at, well, why are you investing in property anyway? And we've always sort of alluded to property being a really sound investment because of the ability to get leverage. Typically, growth rates in property have been significant, and the ability for people to make a lot of money and create wealth out of property is because you could use other people's money to get into it. Because it is a high you know, cost transaction to get in, you know, decent properties. And the banks love it. They're willing to lend against it, and they're typically willing to lend against it at lower rates compared to other assets.
Yep.
So obviously now we've just outlined within super, that's no longer the case.
Mm.
You know, the ability to get the leverage is getting harder, and the rates for that leverage don't make sense.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can still get exposure to property in super. As you said, Louis, if you've got a big enough balance, you just buy it outright or get a very small amount of borrowings, so there's less risk.
Mm.
And when we were talking to anyone that was looking to buy inside or outside super, we typically had a number of strategies you would look at. So we sort of categorized them as just a passive type investment where you would just buy and hold the property. Assume the capital growth is going to be there, get the numbers right, and you're just buying something, you're putting a tenant in, and hopefully there's minimal maintenance costs, and you just have a property manager and allow it to grow in value over time.
And make sure those cash flows get very close to at least matching one another.
Yeah.
You don't want to,
you're not out of pocket holding it.
Yeah, you don't want to have a significant negative cash flow position.
Yeah. So we know that that's no longer on the table with what we've just outlined.
Okay. So what are the property opportunities then?
Okay. Well, we also have other strategies where we called it a value add. Now, this doesn't always work inside super, where you could buy a property and renovate it and sort of create your own capital growth by spending less on the increased value than what the market would pay for it. But within super, that's hard because you can't borrow to do that. So again, we wouldn't say that's an opportunity within super. And potentially we also have properties overseas that you can get high yields on, which makes sense. So the cash flow's there. But to do that within super, you still need to have a significant balance. So the one strategy we haven't discussed on this podcast at all that gives exposure to property, but it's not direct ownership, is actually through development.
Yeah.
Where, you know, anyone that has access to a certain amount of money. You don't want to be putting in too little amount, or depending on what the structure is, you may. But developers, when they go to develop a property, so they purchase a site or a house or a block of land that they want to convert into something more significant than what it currently is, they can't do that without having a certain amount of capital up front. So there's costs associated with buying that land, and there's costs associated with getting the permit to develop it, and preparing all of the architectural drawings and all that sort of thing. And they will be able to get some amount of borrowings from a bank, but it will never be the amount that is the total cost of that development. So they need real capital of their own, or providing they've got a sound structure and a strategy that makes sense, they offer the ability for investors to put money in to become that capital.
Right.
And typically, because the returns in the property development space can be quite high, to allow investors to see a decent opportunity, those returns can be upwards of 10%, and quite often upwards of 20%.
Is that
for
right?
For providing the equity to a developer.
Wow.
So that is one strategy. And look, full disclosure, we do have this strategy. We haven't spoken about it on this podcast before, but we do our own developments. And it is something that, if anyone is interested in learning more, we have a current development that we're actually raising capital for. And the beauty of this one is that we're actually doing it through a compliant structure that allows people to invest in it, whether they have individual funds, funds held in a company or a trust, or in a self-managed super fund.
Interesting.
Okay. Now, the difference is you're not a direct owner of property here. You're a shareholder in a company that is going to benefit from the development of property. So you never own the title. You're not the direct owner like we've talked about in other forms of property investing. But you're able to still get exposure to the property market via the development and the increased value that a developer creates. But you're doing it for a profit, not for a long-term hold and growth position.
Correct. So it's right. A much more active approach,
yes.
Value-add approach. Manufactured return approach to real estate investment.
But the investor doesn't have to do, but they need to trust that the people they're investing in are capable of delivering that.
Correct.
So there's a level of disclosure and information that obviously they need to understand. And with the one we're doing it under a public company. So there's a prospectus that's issued that's a full disclosure document. So, if anyone is going to look at investing in it, all the information's laid out for them so that they can have the comfort that that they're investing with the right people in the right way.
And the financials get audited independently.
Yeah.
I mean, it's run very similar to a very similar standard to a listed company. Not quite to the same standard with the disclosure and the ongoing reporting requirements, but certainly in regards to the corporate governance, that type of structure needs to meet very high standards.
Absolutely. And of course, because it's a public company under a prospectus that's being outlined, it has to be registered with ASIC. So the regulator has to have approved that before we can actually offer that to the market.
Right, okay. Mm. So it sounds like for someone who is going to invest in it, yes, it's a property-related investment, but it's less reliant on the property market and more reliant on the ability to have a project that has proper costs built into it and then sells at the end at a profit. But it's all sort of budgeted in.
Yeah.
So as long as the final product is a good one and can sell to the people who eventually buy it, well, then the profit margin's kind of built in, isn't it?
It is. Well, if you look at the traditional model of developing property, that the whole goal is to be able to identify a site, meaning a piece of land, whether it's got a dwelling on it or a building on it of some nature, but that has a better and higher purpose than its current one.
Okay.
So you can either take a vacant block and you know you can build a certain structure on it that will have a far more increased value at the end of it that the market will accept and pay for than what the cost of delivering it is. So it's a business model in effect.
Okay.
And so when we've looked at this development, we've identified a site in a really, really nice area of Melbourne that is currently a commercial site, but it has the ability to have residential and commercial built on it to, you know, a much higher level than what the current building is. So the current building itself, you know, has a value, but not significant compared to what the overall potential of this site could be. And so we've got a really qualified team of consultants, architects, town planners, sales agents that have all given us guidance. So we've been able to identify, you know, what the increased value of this site could be. And when we've run our numbers, we've seen that there's enough profit in there based on all of these numbers there that there's a significant return on investment so that it makes sense to proceed.
Yeah, okay. So when you've got a site, really the value add is in initially identifying that site.
Yeah.
And then once you've got that, then it's a matter of, well, not fucking it up.
And that is a key part of it. And look, the not fucking it up component, we put down to really leveraging off quality people.
Yeah.
People that have been there, done that, you know, trusted, really know their space and have got a track record of delivering.
Well, there's people whose whole career is based on this.
Absolutely,
isn't there?
There is.
And they just rinse and repeat the same process, the same methodology, the same scrutiny and due diligence, and they just do project after project after project and consistently deliver them at profit.
If you look at the BRW Rich List that's released every year or so, they the people in there that it says have made their money from property, it's not from buy and hold strategies.
No.
It's through development where you can buy an asset that you can spend a smaller amount of money on top of buying that asset compared to what the value at completion is.
Okay.
And that's how they've built their significant wealth, like Harry Trigubovs of the world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Gandalf. Significant amount.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So to sum it up, Brett, what you're saying is for people that were going to invest in direct property through their super, there's another option that's out there for them.
Absolutely.
Property development investment being being one of an
One of them.
One of an several investors into a project, and that will get me on the BRW Rich List. Thank
nice
you.
Nice summary.
I'll take it.
Actually, I'll put a couple of caveats over that.
Oh, no.
But the first
boring.
One is not every property development can be invested in by people with self-managed super. I mean, obviously, you can't invest in property in any form of structure with a retail or an institutional super fund other than through different means. Whereas if you have a self-managed super fund, you've got more flexibility with what you can invest in.
Yep.
And because
but it still has to be the right structure.
It still has to be the right structure. And because this is a public company structure, it allows for self-managed super funds to be able to invest into it.
Okay. So you've got to find the right one.
Yeah. So and that's part of the reason that when we've gone down the path of doing this development that we've set it up that way, because we know there are people with self-managed super funds that we're aware of that would like exposure to these types of investments because the rates of return are significant. And so we wanted to make it not only attractive in terms of the return, but compliant and accessible.
Yep. Right.
Hence we have done so.
Okay.
But while we're talking about it, I'll just let anyone that is listening that would like more information, there's this project-specific website for the one we're doing. We won't go into too much detail now, but if anyone wants to know, they can simply go to developments.ugc.net.au.
Thank you, Brett.
Fantastic.
Sure. All right. Well, we're going to take another short break, and we'll be back with you soon.
Are you concerned about your finances? Maybe you're not sure if you'll have enough money to retire on. Or maybe you've received a redundancy, inheritance, or even a significant promotion, or perhaps a life-changing medical diagnosis. Regardless of your concern or financial position, United Global Capital's advisors are experts in the areas of strategic financial planning, taxation, superannuation and self-managed superannuation funds, risk management, estate planning, and investments. Don't let fate dictate your financial future. Take control today and contact United Global Capital for a no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. simply call 03 8657 7640 or email info@ugc.net.au and book your appointment today.
Welcome back, listeners. Look, just on the back of that conversation with Brett, Brett and Joel, I was sitting next to you this week when the results on those interest rates came in, and hearing that the interest rates were going higher and higher on self-managed super fund borrowings, got me thinking too. Well, if borrowing to invest in property through a self-managed super fund is not the viable option that it used to be, and if the strategy that's best for a person is to get some kind of leverage through their super, then what are their options?
Well, there's a number, isn't there, Louis?
No, well, there still is.
I mean, this doesn't put the death nail in your ability to grow your wealth through super and do it a little bit more aggressively if you're that way inclined.
No, that's right.
It just needs to be done slightly differently.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there's an important point here on the loan to value ratio side of things. When you're talking about investing outside of super with your personal money and borrowing 100% of the purchase price to buy an investment property, there's real advantages to doing that. But when it comes to your superannuation balance, you don't need 100% loan-to-value ratio. In fact, you probably don't want 100% loan-to-value ratio. It's more about taking the superannuation balance that you have and magnifying it to an extent.
Yes.
So you might want a loan-to-value ratio of 20% borrowings or 50% borrowings. Property, you can get as high as 70% borrowings, but now we know that if you're going to do that, all the interest rate's too high.
Yep.
But it's more about enhancing the returns that you could get on some kind of asset, that which is a good asset to invest in.
Yes.
So, are there options for the property market to leverage?
Well, most definitely. So, there are a number of different structures. So Brett talked about a public unlisted company where you can invest in developments that do the borrowing internally. There's a number of those products on listed exchanges or even unlisted products that will give you similar types of internal borrowing scenarios. That's where you yourself don't borrow, but the fund structure does the borrowing within the fund. So you've got investments like listed property trusts or REITs, Australian REITs, real estate investment trusts now, that, like, you know, think of your Lendleases, your Mervacs, your General Property Trust, GPT, where they themselves will go out and do developments on a large scale. Often they're big towers and big commercial real estate projects, and they'll go and do the borrowing. And by just being a passive investor in their units that are listed on the Australian Stock Exchange, you get the benefit of the activities of real estate development and the real estate that they own that is already got some debt against that to try and juice up and enhance those returns or magnify those returns.
Okay, great. So property market, we can still get some kind of leverage return.
Most definitely.
Well, I'm going to talk about share markets. In share markets outside of superannuation, if you're going to invest in shares, the traditional option is to have a margin loan. But I think even these days, it's fair to say that margin lending is a bit dead because of the interest rates you get.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep. And it's very restrictive as well. The margin lenders will typically only give you the ASX 300 shares to choose from.
Okay. But there is a different way to achieve a similar result, which is a contract for difference, or CFD.
Yeah.
Which, in effect, kind of achieves the same thing as a margin loan, but it's structured differently, which is allowable for definitely for direct investors, but is also an allowable way for a self-managed super fund to get leverage in their portfolio.
Correct. Yeah. So anyone who's going down the pathway of thinking about investing through contracts for difference need to be aware that you're not actually owning the physical shares of a company. What you are owning is a contract that replicates the performance of those shares. And by getting access to that contract, you typically only have to put down a percentage of the level of exposure that you're hoping to get access to. So let's take like a company like BHP Billiton. If you wanted to buy $10,000 worth of exposure to BHP Billiton, depending on the CFD provider that you're trading with, they might only ask you to put down $1,000 or $1,500 to back that position. Now, you do need to be aware, though, that if the value of that equity that you have in that position falls below the minimum value that that CFD provider wants you to maintain, you could be on the hook for additional capital being put in to top up the equity value in that position.
Right. I mean, a share like BHP, or in fact any share on the market, is you can expect at some point it's going to have a 10 or 20% correction.
Correct.
If you've got a $10,000 investment, but you've only got $1,500 on the table, mm-hmm. and that share comes down by 15%, your $1,500 is wiped out.
Correct.
It's gone to zero.
Are you then pursued for the balance?
You can be, yeah. Right. Absolutely. So even if that then goes into negative, the CFD provider can then come after you personally for the difference.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, well, not you personally, but right. the other assets in your account.
Yeah, that's right. The other assets yep. in your account.
Yep. Right. Exactly.
So you do need to be very careful about how you use these. Now, we do use these internally. We've got some clients that want to have that additional risk and are comfortable with that. It's not a strategy for everybody. But we typically recommend clients maintain a loan-to-value ratio of no more than about 55% when dealing with contracts for difference.
Well, there's a lot less risk associated with that.
Most definitely.
You can ride out any of the volatility.
Correct.
You know, and even a 30% correction, you're still in the game.
Very much so.
So when you say loan-to-value ratio, are we talking, using the BHP example there, if you had wanted $10,000 of exposure, you're actually putting up roughly $4,500. Is that the way you...
Yeah, so you would have $4,500 of equity or cash in your account that backs that $10,000 exposure.
Right. Yeah.
And the advantage is when it makes gains... if it makes a 10% gain, well, then you've got $1,000 return on the $4,500 mm-hmm. that you had on the table.
Correct. Yeah.
Which is not a 10% gain, it's a much larger gain.
Yeah. Yeah,
let's do some maths.
25%.
Yeah, 22.5.
The whole reason we want to use leverage when investing is for that purpose.
Exactly. So that is another way that you can gain access to leverage in the stock market. Using both inside super and outside super, but you do have to have a self-managed super fund to get access to it. Other methods of getting leverage?
Well, just on that, CFDs that we're talking about getting into direct shares here, aren't we?
Correct, that's right.
So if we don't want to buy individual shares, then what do we do to have a bit more of a passive approach, but still with leverage?
So outside of using contracts for difference, we could use some other products like exchange-traded funds. And many of these exchange-traded funds, often you can get leveraged exposure through an exchange-traded fund as well. Now, what's an exchange-traded fund? It's typically a product that is designed to replicate the performance of an underlying index. So you can buy an exchange-traded fund on the ASX 200, which essentially gives you the mirrored price performance of the ASX's 200 largest companies, or it could be on technology shares, the S&P 500, the NASDAQ 100. You know, you pick your market, you pick your index that you want to get exposure to.
And you can also get exchange-traded funds, which are similar to what used to be managed funds, where you have a fund manager that's choosing which companies they think are good based on a certain method of investing. Mm-hmm. So really, when you buy into one exchange-traded fund, you've got some investment methodology that is executed within that fund, whether it's tracking an index like you talk about, or if it's a fund manager that's buying and selling the underlying investments that it chooses.
Correct. Yeah. So... and you can get these products that will often give you 2 times the daily performance or 3 times the daily performance of that underlying index or portfolio that that is being managed.
Wow.
So, you know, if the S&P 500 goes up by 1% today, then your portfolio should almost go up by 2%. But same thing happens on the reverse side.
Yeah.
So you've got to make sure that you've got some conviction with that particular point of view and that investment that you're taking.
Yeah, but the strategy should be for a long-term view.
Absolutely.
We're talking about self-managed super fund investors here.
Yep.
And borrowing to invest. Well, firstly, to be in share markets anyway, or any growth asset, you've got to be talking long-term, 5 years or 7 years or more.
Most definitely.
And when you're talking leverage, you're talking 7 years, 10 years, and for many people in this type of aggressive strategy, 20 years to retirement.
That's right.
So if you're going to get into a kind of 2 times or 3 times leveraged investment, you've got a 20-year horizon. I think it's a, well, can I say it's a fairly likely scenario that the market in 10 or 20 years' time is going to be higher than what it is today?
I think that's a safe bet. And quite possibly significantly higher.
Yep. I mean, has it happened before that there's been a 10-year period where markets haven't performed?
From my understanding, there's never, ever been a 10-year period on the Australian stock market in any rolling 10-year period where there's been a negative return when you take into account the impact of dividends.
There you go. So a long-term approach. Yep. So there's still ways to leverage your super.
Yep.
Excellent.
Absolutely. Mm.
Well, thanks, guys. Great discussion on that. And good to know that even though one option's been taken away from self-managed super fund investors, there's still some more out there.
Mm. Most definitely.
Yep. All right. All right. Listeners, into our favourite section every week.
Cannot be serious!
What have we got this week, gents?
I'll kick one off.
You kick it off, mate.
We talk about data and statistics a lot, and I'm calling bullshit on some of these, and I think all of us here will agree, champion data.
The most important data collection.
The most important
firm.
Data. You knew we couldn't get away from this topic for a whole episode.
That's right. Football statistics.
Have pulled out their rankings of every AFL team's list. So the players on the team and as a collective, how they rank that team's potential. So the two teams that played off in last year's grand final, of course, Collingwood and West Coast, are not in the top two. In fact, they're not even in the top four in terms
really?
Of lists. Yeah, so I think we can both agree on the basis of that, Louis, it's crap.
It can't be serious.
So unbelievably, they've put Collingwood's list at five, which Joel and I have been through diligently and can't see how it could fall below one.
Rubbish.
And I think as equally shocking is that they've got West Coast's list rated as number 11.
11?
11 out of 18. Yeah. So that just shows it's just crap.
Yeah.
And look, to support my theory here, last year they ranked Sydney, Port Adelaide, Adelaide and GWS as the top four, and Collingwood and West Coast were rated 10th and 11th before last year.
Really?
What's the old saying? There's lies, damn lies, and then there's statistics. I've got one, guys. We're coming into the Christmas season. Christmas parties are being thrown left, right, and centre. And EY has made the news this week.
EY?
Ernst Young.
Wow.
Yeah. They have just recently had a bash for their clients with a price tag of $4 million.
You cannot be serious!
Whoa!
Now, it wasn't a Christmas party, but what it was Ooh. Was a Future Realize conference. And obviously, EY has a number of, you know, very...
That's code important, word for junket.
Yeah, very important clients. And that was held on Cockatoo Island. So, you know, that little island in the harbour in Sydney Harbour?
Oh, right. Yes.
Yep. So, but they had guests like Julie Bishop, Stan Grant, Alan Joyce, and they also had Bob Geldof.
Oh,
as,
wow.
As one of the performers.
That's yeah. Sir Bob Geldof.
Yes. Sir Bob Geldof. But
so that was half of the cost.
Yeah. So for the couple of days that they had that function, $4 million, most of it was spent on flights and accommodation. So I don't know how you feel about being a partner or shareholder in the EY business, but things must be pretty good at EY.
Must be. Accounting, lucrative business.
Yeah.
You cannot be serious!
Have you ever wondered what banks do with their old bank vaults?
Yes,
I would be curious. Yeah.
Well, apparently they just abandon them and leave them out in the open. Well, at least that's what they do in Florida, in the USA,
yeah.
Where this week a teenager walked into one of these abandoned bank vaults and the door was accidentally shut behind him.
Oh.
You cannot be serious!
What happened there?
Well, he was stuck.
And?
And, well, his mate was on the other side.
And he's still there?
And
those vaults, you know, you
slipping
can't
trays it. Of food underneath the door. Yeah. No, it's more secure than that. His mate tried a few things. Obviously, none of them worked, and it actually took a few hours for him to get the courage to call the authorities to rescue him.
Wow!
But it took them most of a day to release him.
Wow!
Because they tried cutting the concrete, but of course, it's reinforced with steel. And we're talking 2 feet of concrete.
Wow.
So, yeah.
That's incredible.
They eventually got him out.
They should have just called the Hollywood producers. They know how to you know, cut through all those vaults when they make those movies.
Do you call George Clooney, yeah, Brad Pitt.
Do you think that perhaps the mate who was on the outside of the vault
pushed the door shut?
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, that's not a very light door. I don't think the wind's going to blow it shut.
No, that's right.
Yeah, I think you're on track there.
Yeah.
All right.
Can I go again?
I'll give you permission, Brett.
Thanks,
guys. I'll give you permission.
I've got one for the thrill seekers here. I saw this and I was actually quite shocked. A US man was on a trip and he decided to go hang gliding. And the footage is actually online. Maybe we'll share a link in our notes. Where he's taken off with the main hang glider person who forgot to strap him in. So they've gone off a 4,000-foot cliff, and for a whole two-minute journey, he's hanging on by his bare hands.
Oh, my God.
Whoa. Shit scared for his life.
You cannot be serious.
Unbelievable. So he struggled to hold on for the two-minute journey. Apparently, the pilot, so to speak, of the hang glider was holding him as well throughout the whole journey once he realised his mistake.
Wow.
Oh, and fortunately, it all worked out all right. And he's willing to hang glide again now that he realised the error.
Right. Not with the same instructor.
No, probably not.
No. I wonder if he got a refund. Jeez. Thanks, gents. It's been a great episode today. We'll catch you again next week.
Thanks
listeners.
Thanks, Brett.
Okay,
cheers,
bye.
Guys.
You've been listening to this week's episode of The Investor Exchange. To access this episode's show notes, go to theinvestorexchange.com.au and follow us on Facebook at The Investor Exchange for updates on our latest episodes. This show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. Before making any investment decision, contact United Global Capital by emailing ugc.net.au for a personalised, no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Or alternatively, email us at info@ugc.net.au.